Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The two-parter today. Later we hear from the director of Broadway's Hamilton, Tommy Cahill. He has another show, an earlier collaboration with Lin-Manuel Miranda, opening at the Knight Theater next week, and we'll talk with him later about Freestyle Love Supreme. First, after several weeks of early voting, yesterday was primary election day in North Carolina. On the ballot here, races for city council, mayor, district attorney, sheriff, and many others, and there were also house races galore, along with the big one, the primary for U.S. Senate. So, who will face the voters in the city election in July? And the other races in November. Let's recap the wins and losses with a touch of the why thrown in for good measure. WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison is here. He's also the host of our Inside Politics podcast, and WFAE's Dr. Michael Bitzer. We just claimed you. I don't know why, but we just did. He's the chair of the Political Science and Department and professor of Politics and History at Catawba College. Welcome to you both. Morning.
Good to be claimed.
Let's start big. The U.S. Senate race to replace retiring Republican Richard Burr. On the Republican side, Ted Budd, the Trump endorsee, $11 million from the conservative PAC Club for Growth. Pre-election polling had him way ahead, and the outcome proved that to be right. Would that be true, Steve?
Yeah, I think there was no surprise that Ted Budd defeated Pat McCrory, but you know, that pre-election polling had him ahead, but by like 10 points, 12 points, 15 points. And what happened last night was pretty stunning, that Pat McCrory lost by nearly 35 percentage points. Ted Budd won 99 of the 100 counties. I mean, almost won Mecklenburg. I mean, it's like 100 votes. And so the size of Pat McCrory's loss was a little jaw-dropping.
What was it, the endorsement, Michael, or was it something else? One pundit said the other day that throughout this campaign, Pat McCrory floundered to find a message, whereas Ted Budd had one from the start.
Well, I think certainly when you're talking about Republican Party politics, everybody now is in the Trump lane. That's the dominant dynamic and factor within Republican Party politics. And to have that support of the former president helps to differentiate folks. And I think that that, along with the onslaught of the multi-million dollars from Club for Growth, really did kind of accentuate the dynamic and make that spread so wide. You know, I think this was an interesting test case, because I believe this was the first primary where both Club for Growth and Donald Trump agreed on the same candidate. And that 1-2 punch really played a big difference.
And if we're looking at, I've lost the question. It's gone. Let's talk about the future of Pat McCrory. I was going to ask this morning if this means that his political career is over, but he kind of said it in a story that you had on the air this morning, Steve. It's over.
Yeah, that's what he said. He was at his kind of gathering. I guess you can't call it a party, but his gathering last night was at Selwyn Pub in Myers Park. And he said, hey, you know, I started my political career just a few blocks away when he was elected to city council in 1989. And then said it ends here. And, you know, it was kind of, I guess, remarkable in a way that, you know, at the city level, he dominated Charlotte politics for so long, winning so easily. And then his two losses for governor, you know, with one victory in between, were really close. I mean, Roy Cooper beat him only by a few votes. And then I think, you know, when you lose the way he lost last night, that makes it difficult to kind of see a path as in the Republican Party moving
and
forward.
And he's been a political animal for so long that now he has to kind of reevaluate what's going to happen next for him.
Now I've got to do some real self-evaluation of where I belong. And not only me, it's not me, it's where these people belong in our party. Because I want to make sure we maintain a sense of civility, a sense of common sense, a sense of character and accomplishment. And I think the candidates are going to have to prove to this group of people who still represent a pretty large majority of the voters that they need to be appealed to.
So he's talking, Michael, there about the fact that they're fielding candidates in the Republican Party that do really well in primaries, but maybe will not do so well in the general election. What do you foresee in this one with Ted Budd will go up against Sherry Beasley, the Democratic winner?
Exactly. And I think, you know, what I have been astounded by is perhaps the party moved and Pat McCrory stood still. I think the party moved underneath him and he just was not able to keep that dynamic as part of the established party regimen. And I think in November, we're going to have a classic party-based kind of an election. This is a midterm election. People are going to be voting loyally. They're going to be voting R or D. It doesn't matter necessarily who the candidates are. And this will be a real contest come November.
Yeah, and he criticized in that previous clip that we heard, he gave a warning to Republicans. He did it again, as a matter of fact.
And the Republican side, I hope we see some honesty about some leaders in our party that maybe don't have the character or temperament to lead our party in the future. And we need to be honest about that. As I said, right policies, but maybe we need to look for other people with better temperament and policy and values.
Who's he talking about, Steve?
So I think that, you know, primarily that would be Donald Trump. Number two, Madison Cawthorn. And then I think he would put Ted Budd in that category a bit, though he wasn't quite willing to say it. And he was asked several times, will you endorse Congressman Budd? And he withheld that for now. Now, I kind of reading between the lines, I think he will come around and endorse him at some point. He said, you know, he felt really hurt, offended that he was called a rhino, Republican in name only. And he had this statement where he's like, well, if they were calling me that just to win the election, maybe that's one thing. If they really meant it, that's another. So I think he'll come back into the fold. I think he'll support Ted Budd. But, you know, I mean, you put yourself out there, you lose. It's a hard night. And
yeah, but if you criticize other people in the party and question their leadership strengths and their temperament and then endorse them in the general election, what does that say about you?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's okay. I think he's going to struggle with that. And, you know, it is possible that he takes a couple of weeks or a few weeks off and says, you know, I really am done. I'm not going to be running again. And maybe he doesn't, right? Maybe if you're not seeking office in the future, then maybe you just say, you know, to heck with it. I'm going to sit this one out.
So
maybe that's going to happen.
What kind of campaign, Michael, does Sherry Beasley have to run against Ted Budd?
I think she has to run a very strategic, almost thread the needle type of run. This November is a lean Republican seat. It's a Republican advantage year. The president's party gets, you know, hammered at the polls, typically in midterms. Inflation is going to be at the top of the concern. We're going to have a host of issues, abortion, January 6th, who knows what else will come. But this is a advantage Republican environment built in already. Midterms tend to see more registered Republicans show up. They are party loyalist than necessarily registered Democrats. And registered unaffiliated, it's the biggest group in North Carolina, don't necessarily show up at turnout rates comparable to partisans. So this is going to be a real uphill battle for Beasley, I think.
On the local level yesterday, Mecklenburg County voters made selections in 24 races, including mayor, city council, county commission, sheriff, district attorney, and a few others. Any surprises in the local U.S. House races in either the 12th or the 14th districts, which are in Mecklenburg County, Steve?
No. Alma Adams won her primary easily. Jeff Jackson won his. On the Republican side, Jeff Jackson's in this new 14th district. On the Republican side, Pat Harrigan won. He's a Green Beret veteran. I think that will be an interesting race to watch in that if the national mood really favors Republicans this fall, they might put some money in that race. I mean, that's one I think they could possibly win. But no, it was this win about as expected.
Let me back up a second, because Jeff Jackson was widely rumored to want to run for U.S. Senate, withdrew from that race because he said he wanted to spend more time with his family, and in 10 minutes decided to run for the House when they changed the districts. Would he have been a stronger Senate campaigner against Ted Budd than Sherry Beasley?
I think you can definitely make that argument that Jeff Jackson is a very gifted politician. And I think maybe perhaps deep down, he might think so, that he might be the better general election candidate. But I think it was going to be really hard for him to win the Democratic primary. And I think he saw that there was really no path to win. I'm sure that he thinks like that he can do it.
And with Beasley's historic candidacy, I think she's going to draw on a core constituency of Democratic base voters. And that is what is critically needed to be competitive in this kind of an environment.
Around the country and here in North Carolina, a lot of people were focused on one particular House race, and that's in the 11th district, where freshman Congressman Madison Cawthorn was running for re-election against a field of fellow Republicans, one of whom was a former supporter. He faced a series of scandals, a weakening Trump endorsement. And last night, just prior to the announcement of his loss, here's what he told his supporters.
Thank you so much for being out here, my friends. The race is very close. We know that our opponents, most of his state Senate seats has already been reported. So we're really hopeful that the rest of the votes that are coming in will break our direction. So it's still to be decided, but my friends, I genuinely believe we will take a victory out today. I believe that we will not have a runoff election, and so we should be moving forward to a historic majority to rebuild America and send it back to its former glory.
It was reported that within minutes after making that announcement, he called the winner to concede the election. At least he conceded. Who did win?
Chuck Edwards, the state senator from primarily Henderson County, but also Buncombe County, who basically drained Madison Cawthorn's home county support and helped him win.
Of course, Mayor Vi Lyles won in a landslide in the Democratic primary for re-election. Any surprises on the Republican side in terms of who they chose to run against her in July?
No, they're county endorsed candidates for mayor and at-large city council all move forward. I think Republicans trying to win a seat on city council in a way were disappointed that former Mayor Patrick Cannon did not win or did not advance, because that was going to be a really key part of their message this summer.
Yeah, there were some surprises in terms of the at-large races on council. In terms of the winner, Braxton Winston was the biggest vote getter, followed by Dimple Ashmera, Luana Mayfield, who's running to return to council, and Smudgy Mitchell also running to return to council. They beat Larkin Eggleston.
Yeah, Larkin Eggleston had raised by far the most money, nearly $140,000. That should be enough to get your message out. That's usually a winning sum for an at-large city council race. Larkin had missed the endorsement of the Black Political Caucus by two votes earlier this year. Now, if he had gotten that, would it have, we don't know if he would have won, but you know, it's a really important endorsement. I think in the city and county races, their candidates won 13 of 15 races. So he missed that endorsement, finished fifth, and now he's off of city council.
And in the at-large commission races, the nominees that were endorsed by the Black Political Caucus tended to walk away with it. Pat Cotham, Lee Altman, Arthur Griffin, and there was a fourth one whose name escapes me at the moment, Steve.
Quickly. Well, just those three won, because they only have three at-large seats, and the three BPC candidates...
Gary McFadden will be returning as sheriff. Spencer Merriweather wins the Democratic primary for district attorney. Thank you both. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The Broadway juggernaut Hamilton recently completed a weeks-long run here in Charlotte. If you've seen it here or elsewhere, you're hearing the words of Lin-Manuel Miranda. But the spectacle that is Hamilton, the work of taking this creative twist on the story of the nation's founding and putting it on its feet, is that of Tommy Cale.
To King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get cold. I shoulder every burden, every disadvantage I've learned to manage. I don't have a gun to brandish. I walk these streets famished. The plan is to fan this spark into a flame. But damn, it's getting, so let me spell out the name. I am the A-L-E-X-A-N-D-E-R. We are meant to be.
He won Broadway's Tony Award for Best Direction of a Musical for Hamilton and numerous other awards for direction, including the Drama Desk Award for directing Miranda's In the Heights. But next week, Charlotte theatergoers get to go back in time and witness some of Cale's earlier work. Freestyle Love Supreme will run from May 24th through the 30th at the Knight Theater. And here to talk about that and more is its co-creator, Tommy Cale. Welcome. Nice to meet you.
I'm very pleased to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Let me start with a very basic question. What is Freestyle Love Supreme?
The question I've been trying to answer for 18 years. Freestyle Love Supreme is an improvisational hip-hop comedy show that a couple of us made in really the early 2000s, 2003, 2004, Anthony Vinicielli and Lin-Manuel and I all went to college together. Anthony and I were friends from college. We met Lin when we graduated a couple years later. He was younger. And as I like to say, he was a freshman and I was a senior and I was not talking to freshmen. So I heard about Lin, but I never met him until we graduated. And we were working on these really early rehearsal workshops for In the Heights, and in the breaks from rehearsal, Anthony would grab Lin and they would freestyle about anything. So basically freestyling is, it's sort of removing your filters. It's allowing anything to flow through you. You lay down a beat, you put words on top, that's freestyling. So it's this very elemental form of hip hop. And Anthony and Lin would always be, I mean, basically doing anything but rehearsing. And so I was trying to drag them back into the rehearsal room. They said, hey, we think there's something here. And they kind of cooked up this idea for a show that would take information and inspiration from the audience and then spin it into stories and songs. And that's really what we're still doing 18 years later.
I have to ask you, can you do it yourself?
I can only do it when I'm not on NPR. So it's okay. It's something, you know, very early in the morning when there are no microphones.
For people who may not be terribly familiar with that whole style or that show, Freestyle Love Supreme, if you watch the Tony Awards, I think it was last year, the ending number in that was done by Freestyle Love Supreme. And it was amazing because they recapped what had happened that night at the Tonys. They could not possibly have pre-planned any of it. So it's all improvised, and worse, it rhymes.
Hello, 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 we're Freestyle Love Supreme. You're watching the Tonys. We've been backstage with our team. We've just been screaming and crying and clapping in the wings. I mean, Adina and Audra and Tina, all the things. We'll take tonight's show, put 4 minutes on the clock. Recap the Tonys so most of it fits a TikTok. We're not throwing away a shot. Can we do it, maybe? You're ready? We got 4 minutes. Wayne Brady!
Oh, New York was always a sensation. Broadway shows and big red carpet nights.
Wayne Brady, 4 minutes.
It's been over a year, but the Tonys are here, and now we're always back to...
I just find that amazing. It's brilliant, but it has to be incredibly scary. How do you do that for 2 hours?
Well, luckily, we only do it for 95 minutes.
Well, so even
so, you'll be home in time for dinner. the short of it is it comes from trust and communication and listening. And so when our group started, there were six of us in the group on stage, and I was always off stage. And then over these last, 4 or 5 years in particular, the group has expanded and now there's 25 members of the group. Mm-hmm. And so that's the beauty of it. Whoever is on stage that night is who's on stage. It's very similar to a sports team. I really feel like directing the show is much like coaching a basketball team, something that Charlotte knows a lot about. And so you don't know what you're going to get energetically from the, from the other players, but you know there's a structure and a shape that exists. But everything that fills in is really absolutely made up on the spot. And I think that's something that feels like a magic trick, but it's true. And it, just like anything else, it comes from deep practice. I mean, years and years of doing it, of exercising this muscle. It is something that we believe everybody can do. And that's actually part of the ethos of the show. And in fact, we have this, you know, whole arm of our group called Freestyle Supreme Academy that teaches freestyling to performers, to non-performers, to people that, you know, want to enhance their confidence in public speaking, to students who are in 11th grade. We do lots of it virtually. There's also brick and mortar, but it's something that we found is really, you know, I think focused mostly on expression of self. And I think that's what people respond to. That's why the show is so funny, because what we're able to do on stage is create these very true moments that resonate with audiences.
On the one hand, it's improvised. And on the other hand, there, you said there's a structure to it. I'm wondering where the story comes from. Does it come from the audience? Do you come in with the story and ask for, how does it work?
Yeah, so I mean, so it depends. Like there are, you know, six or seven sort of songs that we do throughout the course of the evening. And for one of them, which is called Second Chance, we ask the audience to tell us a story from their past about something they wish they could redo. Mm-hmm. And often it's the most embarrassing thing that happened to them when they were 8 years old. And we all hear the story. There's a microphone that goes out into the audience, and there's a really funny back and forth for 5 or 6 minutes. And that person tells the story. And then you watch our group, which just heard the story, recreate it and then rewind and go back and play it differently, as if something else had happened. And so that's a story that comes directly from the audience. There's one of our songs, it's called True. And all we ask for in that is a word that's meaningful to you. And that word can be absolutely anything. And at this point, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shows in, we've heard most of them. Wow. But it could be mom, it could be birthday, it could be automobile. And then in that song, each of the performers tells a true story from their own life that connects to that word. So sometimes the story is generated from the audience, sometimes it's generated from the performers.
You are a director, a Tony Award-winning director, and you've directed on television. You were involved with Fosse Verdon, which was stunningly wonderful, as a matter of fact. But how does a director direct an improvisational piece? You're not there for what's going to happen.
That's right. And I feel like this is where the coaching analogy really kicks in. You know, I directed a play about Vince Lombardi on Broadway about 10 or 11 years ago, and I'm fascinated by leadership. And as someone who grew up playing sports and not doing theater, I played soccer and baseball and basketball my whole life. And when I stopped playing sports, I realized that there was a tremendous amount in common between an athlete and a performer. Likewise, the coach and the director. So my job is to try to unify a group of people that have never met and make sure we all know what story we're trying to tell and that we're telling it the same way. Just like a coach is trying to unify a group of people often who have never met and point them towards a common goal. So the way that you rehearse improv is very similar to the way you rehearse a scene. Again, you give a suggestion, you watch it play out. And then what you're talking about in that rehearsal is, how did you accept that offer? If you and I were in a scene and you said, now we're going to walk into the store and I'm going to buy you a coffee. The job of the improviser, the job of the partner is to say, thank you for the coffee. And now I'm going to get you this, right? This yes and thing that you hear about, because it's very easy to deny and get the easy laugh, but it actually shuts the scene down. So right. A lot of it's just about making sure that we're building trust and communication. And those things are no different than if I was directing Hamilton or In the Heights or some of the other scripted work that I've done.
I would think that not everybody can do this, but people come and go in this production of Freestyle Love Supreme, and in New York, where it's been done a lot, among them, Josh Groban. Now, I don't think of Josh Groban as a rapper. He's a tremendous talent, but not a rapper. Wayne Brady, I think of him as an improvisational person and an actor, a comedian, not so much a rapper. How does that work? Why would Josh Groban put his life on the line, essentially, to do something like this in front of a New York audience?
Well, I cannot speak for Josh about that, but I will say a couple things. One is, when we have guests come into the show, and these are two distinct examples, and it's great to be able to talk about this. When someone like Josh comes in, who's a friend, he might come and do two or three shows, and Josh will find a way to sit in that is directly related to his talent. Mm-hmm. Josh, obviously, is a pretty well-known singer. And Josh is someone who often sings other people's material, but he has an incredible ability to improvise his singing. So Josh will sit in on a song where he's really focusing on the melodic line and carrying through the chorus, even though it will be completely improvised. And then if we do something later on where it's a little more of an acting-based game, as opposed to rapping, Josh will jump in there. Now, Wayne Brady, who is actually a member of our group. So Wayne is, you know, Wayne has done many, many, many shows. Wayne is very involved with the Freestyle of Supreme Academy. And Wayne is an incredible rapper. So Wayne can actually do everything. And Wayne was a huge inspiration for us when we first made this show up. And then Chris Jackson and Wayne became friends on a job. And we thought, well, what if the godfather of musical improv actually came and jammed with us? And we invited him. We've been friends with him for a few years. He was in Hamilton in Chicago. And then Wayne watched the show once and then jumped up on stage for the second show as if he'd been doing it for 10 years. And you just realize like, oh, Wayne has been in a lot of situations where he had a particular skill set. And now he was on stage with five or six other people who can do the thing that he can do. And so it was really moving to watch all of that open up because he can sing, he can rap. He's obviously incredibly funny. His brain is lightning fast. And he's like a full-fledged member of our group. Whereas Josh is someone who can, you know, pop in and really wow people and surprise them because they do not think that they're going to get that from Josh Groban. And it's actually pretty fun to witness.
And you don't know who's coming and going on the tour. This is touring, I think, about 10 cities, among them Charlotte. You don't necessarily know who will be on stage in any given performance.
And that's the fun of it, right? Like Wayne went up to Portland and did a show and then like went back home, you know, and Chris Jackson, who played George Washington in Hamilton and was in the Heights, he was available to come and join us in DC. So he's going to pop down to DC for 5 days. You know, we try if we have a heads up, but it happens pretty close to the thing often, just because it's a pretty busy group of folks. But, you know, there's lots of, you know, again, people now like in that 20, 25 range of folks that have done the show dozens and dozens of times. And we sort of say, hey, who's available? We have this core fantastic group that goes and does the show on the road. And then if another friend comes and joins, they join. No one has ever asked for their money back though. Doesn't matter who's on stage. That I give you money back guarantee and you can call 90.7 WFAE if you don't believe me.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that brought you to the fore, and that would be In the Heights and Hamilton among other projects. But In the Heights, I think people are familiar with it here in Charlotte because it played Charlotte years ago when the Road Company came through, and Hamilton has been here several times and it just finished a several week run here. In the Heights, although Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote it and he started writing it and working on it in college, when he was in college and you were just leaving college, you got a copy of the script before you met him. And you call it, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm telling the story, but
this is all true.
Okay. So you asked if you could meet and talk about it. And he thought he was going to have coffee over it with you. And you came with tons of suggestions and ideas about what to do and how to mount it and how to make it a show. And you just clicked. You didn't know each other at all. And you just clicked. How serendipitous was that?
You know, I remember it like it was last week, you know, I mean, and Lynn and I talk constantly and our joke, which is not really particularly funny, is that we had a conversation that started in May of 2002 and it never ended. And I talked to him last night at 6 o'clock and we texted this morning. It's just like, it's a constant conversation. He goes off and does the work that he does. I do the work that I do. Sometimes we work with other people. Often we work together. And I think there was a spirit of generosity that I found when he was 22 or 23 that's completely present now that he's in his early 40s. And I think that that's something that I felt immediately is this was someone who was operating on a similar frequency, who was looking for collaborators, who understood that I was not trying to fix something that was broken. I only wanted to be additive and help him shape it and inspire him to keep going. And so I think that's what those early days were. You know, in fact, you know, Lynn found this old card I'd written to him from 2004, so 18 years ago now. And at that point, we were 2 years into Heights. And in this card, which I don't remember writing, it's always strange when you see something and you're like, well, it's my handwriting, that is me. But he was cleaning out his office. And this card was basically me saying, both implicitly and explicitly, thank you for believing in me. And even if I don't continue on with this project, we met each other and we'll find each other again. Because, you know, there was a time in those early days, I was a very unproven director. He was somebody, along with those producers, Jill Furman, Jeffrey Seller, and Kevin McCollum, who believed in me. And they believed, even though they had not seen, you know, I was a director. You can only see the work when you're really watching the work or through a rehearsal process, as opposed to me coming in and handing you a script. And so, that faith he had in me, which was in evidence in 2004, was also in evidence in that first meeting. He just thought, oh, okay. As I would say, like, he was over there and I was over here, and we just were in different parts of the forest, and then we met.
That leap of faith is difficult. And I guess anybody who has a spouse or a close friend or has a working relationship with people knows how difficult it can sometimes be to collaborate, particularly when you are the progenitor of the work. If you've created this script and you're handing it over, your baby, over to somebody to direct it or stage it or light it or write music or orchestrations for it, all of that is difficult. And you guys have found this, what I'm told is referred to as Lin-Manuel's cabinet, where you, a choreographer, the orchestrator, and he come together and collaborate. Describe the process, because this is really difficult.
Right. Andy Blankenbuehler is the choreographer you speak of, and Alex Lacamoire is the music director, orchestrator, and arranger. And the four of us met on In the Heights, and then, you know, have continued to work together for these, you know, last 17 years now, really since 2005 when we started working all together. The process is one that is based in a foundation of trust and of respect. We're a group of people that feel like we bring out the best in the other, but we do so with harmony. It's not a group that raises voices. It's not a group that believes that acrimony is a way to create great art. There is a way to use harmony to make excellent things. And I feel like that's actually the work. Like, that's the most important thing that I can contribute, is to try to create an environment where people feel supported and safe enough to not be afraid to say something that is going to make them vulnerable, or an idea that is not fully formed. And I think that only comes from a kind of mutual trust and respect, which we all enter the room with. And so it's been a joy working with them, and it's why we continue to do so, and will continue to do so.
Much more with our guest, Tony Award-winning director Tommy Cale, in just a moment. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. We're joined today by Tommy Cale, Tony Award-winning director of Hamilton and In the Heights. Cale is one of the creators of Broadway's Freestyle Love Supreme, along with Hamilton co-creator Lin-Manuel Miranda. The national touring show opens here in Charlotte next week at the Knight Theater. Before the break, we were discussing the importance of trust in the collaboration between the creators and director of projects like In the Heights and Hamilton. Hamilton is art. Perhaps that's why it has struck a nerve and been so popular. I don't know that people recognize it. Oh, I'm looking at art here. I think if they did, they would run from it. But that's what it is.
Would you like to work a little closer to home?
Actually, I would.
Well, I propose the Potomac.
And you'll provide him his votes.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
Let's go.
No.
What else was in the room where it happened? The room where it happened.
We're seeing the finished product. I'm curious how it all came together, because the way you staged Hamilton is brilliant. Right down to it, deciding that you're going to let a human being be the bullet that kills Hamilton. Spoiler alert, I should have given that. What is the process? How long did it get you? Where did those ideas come from? Do they come organically in the process? Do you sit down with the script and say, here's what's going to happen now, let me watch it in rehearsal? How does it come together?
I mean, it depends. And you know, the manifestation of the bullet as personified by a member of our ensemble was something that Andy talked about really early. It was something that Andy came and said, I think here's an opportunity to physicalize, you know, to have someone stop time, to hold that bullet as it moves towards Hamilton. And so you have this motif that recurs. Ariana DeBose, you know, spent a lot of time in North Carolina, who just recently won a few awards for West Side Story, who was the original bullet in our show, you know, is an incredible actor. I mean, this is someone who 3 months ago was recognized by, or 2 months ago, by the Academy. And she was in our show playing her part to the fullest. And I think that's something that Andy also imbues, that everybody's role matters. It doesn't have a distinction where you're standing on the stage, that we're all storytellers. And so sometimes an idea is brought into the room by the choreographer and Andy says, hey, what do you think about this? Or, hey, I've been cooking this. And then we watch and then we talk and we edit and we suggest together. Sometimes Lynn will bring in half of a song and say, hey, where do you think this can go? And we'll sit and talk about that. Sometimes Alex or I might make a suggestion about what a scene could be. Or, you know, when we first, you know, were working on the show way back in 2011 and 12, you know, Lynn and I both read the book. I asked him to give me a clean read without any of his thoughts. And I said, let's then make our list of scenes and songs and characters and see where we overlap, where the Venn diagram, you know, lays over the other side. And we did that. And we both had our lists of hundreds of things. And many of the things that we talked about in that very first conversation are in the show. One of the things that we both underlined and put a star next to was Burr's line, if I'd read more Stern and less Voltaire, I would have known that the world was wide enough for both Hamilton and me. And that really was at the center of our show. That was something that Lynn and I both said, like, this has to be in the show.
Now I'm the villain in your history. I was too young and blind to see. I should have known the world was wide enough for both Hamilton. Was wide enough for both Hamilton and me.
In the same way that we felt this particular scene with George Washington might be really juicy, or what if Eliza did this? And so the conversations happen everywhere and constantly, and then you get into rehearsal and they start to be refined and shaped. And then to your point, you can watch something and respond and react as it comes off the page. Right. And so the process continues. And I always said, you know, there's a saying, paraphrasing, that plays aren't finished, they're abandoned or they're left, because at a certain point you have to put your pencil down. So That's also the beauty of it. There's a timeline, and then there's a day when you open and you have to say, this is as far as we got.
Wow. In writing about Hamilton in the Washington Post, they quote the New York Public Theater's artistic director as saying about you that you are deeply concerned with, and you've kind of referred to this, how you can deal with this person so that they can be their best, referring to the performers that you're working with. And you've referenced the fact that you came from the world of sports. You wanted to be you were a high school athlete, and you wanted to be at one point a sports caster. Is that where this comes from, this method of working and valuing everybody because they're all part of the team and the team is what makes it all work?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I was someone who was pretty good at sports until I was 12 or 13. And then as the game started to pass me by, I was still good enough to play varsity athletics, but I could see the game more effectively than I could execute. And so I started to have an appreciation because I was a person who used to be in the center of the game playing 90 minutes facilitating. And then I was not that person. So I realized my import when I was in the center. And then I realized my import when I was over on the side. And I realized that what the coach did in trying to mobilize this group and unify this group, I could be of service there because I had a relationship with the team. And so I think that that certainly taught me the value because I used to score goals and now I carry water. It's, you know what I mean? Like, and all of those things are necessary.
So you came to theater really kind of late. You were not a theater kid who at 7 years old was playing Oliver at some community theater production in Alexandria. You got to this, I think, in college and you met up with, I think you had to take a drama class and you met a professor who saw something in you and encouraged you. What did he say to you? What did he see in you?
Well, you know, I started really doing theater my junior year of college when I was, you know, 2021 at Wesleyan University. I had to take a compulsory arts class in high school, and I had a teacher named John Elko when I was in high school, and he said to me, I know you do that, but what if you also did this? And I went into an environment that felt so safe, and I watched the way that he led, and I saw the way that he answered questions with questions. So it really rewired my brain about the role of student teacher, because this was someone who was not just going to give us answers because we asked the question. He wanted us to do more exploration. He wanted us to go and find something and bring back. And also, when you're working on something as subjective as theater, there isn't one way to do anything. And I feel like that's quite distinct from a lot of the other learning that you do when you're coming up, where you're working towards a possible solution. And if you don't get to that solution, then you got it wrong. And I think that I was really freed by this notion that there were different ways to get up, you know, to get up the mountain. And he really encouraged that. And then in college, I took one class in college that actually really bumped me into four or five of the collaborators I spent the next 2 years with. So I only took this one class in script analysis, but it was a really informative time for me, somewhat because of the teaching, which was at a very high level, but mostly because I looked to my left and my right and I said, hey, who are you and who are you? And two of those folks ended up being in my theater company.
In the Heights told a story of an often untold group of people who don't get a chance to tell their story, at least not in the form of Broadway musicals, Hispanics and Latinos. And then your twist on Hamilton tells the story of our founding in a very different way with non-traditional casting. And I'm just curious, that could have been a disaster. It works incredibly well. I'm wondering when you got the idea that it would work.
Well, Lynn and I only conceived of it in that way. It just, it never occurred to us that it would not be that. So from the absolute earliest moment, we thought, well, we have this story that feels like it was way back then. And we want to make sure that if we're using language and we're using lyric and we're using music that is from contemporary art forms, that the show needs to reflect what the world is now, not what the world is then. And so Chris Jackson was always going to be George Washington. There was no question about that. Like, so that's what George Washington looked like, and that's how George Washington would move through the world, and that's how he would sound. Just like David Diggs was going to be Thomas Jefferson, or Renee Goldsberry was going to be Angelica, you know, Leslie and Burr, and on and on and on. And so it never occurred to us that there was another way to tell the story. Like, that was the thing that we knew we had to do.
Fought with him. Me, I died for him. Me, I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
And because you're telling the story in that way, I think that plays a role in why it was so popular, because people are seeing themselves as part of America on stage in a way they never have before. And I think that's maybe you're partly responsible for the all-female casting of 1776, which is coming to Charlotte later on, I think directed by Diane Paulus, and it's all women playing the Founding Fathers. Freestyle Love, let's get back to that, because that's in town. Freestyle Love Supreme, also groundbreaking, because you have a habit of doing this. Groundbreaking in that I think it may be the first Broadway show that's improvised in total. I mean, there's very little that
yeah, maybe you, like you, Nichols in May, right? If you went back like 50 years, like that might have been the last time. So very acutely aware of that. And the fact that it gets to go on the road, I can come to your town. I love the road because I love the idea of you wake up in your town, you live your life, wake up in your bed, have your routine, and we bring our circus to your tent. Yeah. And you don't have to get on a plane, you don't have to get on a bus, you don't have to get on a train, you don't have to get in your car and drive hundreds of miles. I really love the idea of getting out into the country. You know, that's where I saw things and when I grew up in Virginia. And so I feel like, you know, there's a feeling about this show in particular, Freestyle. And a friend of ours named Andrew Freed made a really fine documentary called We Are Freestyle of Supreme that is on Hulu, which really kind of tells the story of how we met and how the show impacted us. But I think what's fun about going on the road is this is an opportunity for catharsis, because this is a show that says what happened in your day, and anything that happened in your day or that you heard on the radio or you read in the paper or you were confronted with at 4 o'clock that day, bring it into the theater, bring it all in, and it can be accessed and it can be talked about. And I think that's what this show offers that no other show does.
The MC is going to use your words over a beat.
Give us a word.
Mascara. Instant noodle.
Nail clippers.
Camouflage.
I'm sorry. Was your name Rambo? Were you in the army? Why the you wearing camo? I can't believe you wear it as a choice. I wear it on my underwear. Now listen to my voice. No. Oh my God.
And it's electric and immediate in that what you're seeing as an audience member has never been seen before, nor will it ever be seen again. And that's got to be, you could come for the entire run and never see the same thing twice.
Absolutely. And we've had people see the show 60, 70, 80 times. I mean, many, many people have seen the show, like the way you follow a band, right? Oh, you might know the set list, but you're going to still travel and go see them. And I feel like as much as, any other show I've ever experienced, this show has those dedicated folks who will just, you know, go see it and then go see it again. Because to your point, the experience that you have is singular. And I think that opportunity exists in the theater in a way that it doesn't with many other art forms.
So before I let you go, I'm just curious as to what is next. I know that you played a major role in the impeccable production of Fosse Verdon, which was about Gwen Verdon and Bob Fosse's and their relationship and their contributions to musical theater over the years. I understand that at one point you were involved in rethinking a movie version of Fiddler on the Roof. Where does that stand and what is next for you?
Fiddler is still hopefully out on the horizon. So that's something I'm still really keen to do, and we'll figure out when the best time to do that is. Mm-hmm. I'm now in pre-production for a new show for Hulu, really plugging for Hulu here, which I'm working on right now, which is called Up Here. And it's an original musical written for television with the partners, Stephen Levinson, who I worked on Fosse with, and Danielle Sanchez, his writing partner. And then Kristen and Bobby Lopez, who wrote Frozen and Coco, have written an entirely original score. So it's shooting in New York this summer. It'll be on hopefully the top of 23, but that's where I'm putting a lot of my time and effort and bringing a lot of our friends from the theater. A lot of Broadway fans, I think, will be very pleased with who's populating this thing that we're making. I'm really excited to work on it.
Final question. So many people who want to do what you do, want to be in theater, want to be in movies and television, who want to be in some role, either on the screen or on the stage or behind the scenes, often think they want to do it because they want to be famous, they want to be well known. They all want to be successful, and that's at the ground level. But I'm going to wager that you and Lin-Manuel Miranda and your collaborators did not do this to be famous. You did it because you were invested in the work. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I've never been interested in that and never thought about that as anything that was related to why we did it. We really loved telling stories. We found that together we were, you know, more than the sum of our parts. And so we stuck together for all this time. And the fact that freestyle is now coming to Charlotte, you know, as a kid from Virginia who spent a lot of time going back and forth to North Carolina, it feels like this thing that I made when I was this younger version of myself, now going to visit, you know, a place that, you know, I know has been supportive of theater, you know, for so long. And I love that the same group of knuckleheads can bring that show to them.
Tommy Cale, the director of Hamilton, In the Heights, and now this production that's touring Charlotte, Freestyle Love Supreme, which runs May 24th through the 30th at the Knight Theater. Thank you for taking time to talk with us. I appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.